Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
First dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? My dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
A shot echoed around the river valley which bisects Rothbury. It and the ensuing shouts of police marksmen could be heard clearly across the village. It was over. Raoul Moat, Britain's most wanted man, had shot himself after a 6.5-hour standoff.
But Tyson wins yet another header. He's won his battle with David Villa tonight, that's for certain. This one's through the middle. It is Arjen Robben. Is this the moment for the Netherlands? Casillas saves Spain. Robben holds his head in his hands and can't believe he's not now accepting the glory. Did that successfully, and Van Persie with the opportunity to play Robben in. Oh, and Robben, was he pulled back? And for the second time, Arjen Robben is frustrated by his own inability to beat Iker Casillas. Netherlands-Spain is 0-0, and we have 30 more minutes to play.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the greatest games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Jonathan Wilson is here with us, of course. And with us as well is Miguel Delaney, chief football writer at The Independent. Miguel, pleasure to welcome you back to the pod.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back. But for the pod I actually wanted to do the first time.
Well, today we go back to the 2010 World Cup final, Netherlands 0, Spain 1. Miguel, why have you chosen this match?
I'd say because it's important to me both personally and professionally. First of all, it was the first World Cup I ever did. World Cup final, well, both World Cup and World Cup final I ever did. Which is obviously kind of, you know, one of the reasons you get into the industry. Although, I mean, this might be a subject for discussion later. I would almost class the Champions League final as the game I'd want to go to more than the World Cup final at this point. But maybe that's related to the other reason, which is the personal reason, that it's, of course, I was privileged to see one of my two countries win the World Cup. And I was actually talking to Johnny Liu about this during the week when he was talking about England winning the Cricket World Cup. After you've experienced something like that, particularly when it's a long way to release, like Spain finally winning it, it feels like no other game they play after that can ever compare. So unless it were Ireland to get to a World Cup final, which is obviously unlikely, maybe that's why I don't see the World Cup final as the game I did then, if you kind of know what I mean, and why I consider the Champions League ahead of it in that sense. But I mean, it's obviously, I mean, I do have to say, even when I was in Russia in 2018, after what had been a slog of a tournament work wise because of all the travel, when I remember coming out into the stadium and thinking like, oh, this is what it's all about, games like this, you know, the feel of it for the final, but obviously that was maxed up to the most possible for my own country being there in 2010. And the other side of that was, I was working for the Irish paper, the Sunday Tribune at the time, which went bust actually about 8 months later, and is one of the reasons I'm in England now. But it meant I didn't have to write live on the game, which would just be inconceivable now. So I was working, but essentially able to watch freely.
Yeah, Jonathan, you've made no... You've not hidden the fact that it's not your favourite World Cup tournament, of course, the 2010 World Cup. But the final itself, I mean, we'll get onto the game in the second part. Did you feel the sort of sense of the occasion, or were you just relieved that it was the final match of a football-wise or adult
there.
Tournament?
World Cups, I've become increasingly aware of this as I've got older. A huge amount, and particularly as a journalist, is about your own experience of it. Mm-hmm. And in 2010, I got it badly, badly wrong. So 2006, I've been covering England, which is, you know, exhausting and dull in its own way. And 2006, I mean, the word Miguel used, slog, is exactly how it felt in 2006. 2010 was even worse. That I'd gone to, I was working for DPA, the German press agency at the time, and they sent me to Rustenburg before the draw was made. And then England end up, they're going to play the US there in the first game, and they decide to base themselves there. So I end up covering England again, like, by mistake. And the nature of South Africa is it's very, very difficult to get around without a car, and I don't drive, so it's very reliant on other people. So I was essentially stuck in Rustenburg. And... for dull work-related reasons, I hadn't booked as early as I normally do to get to the semi-finals. So I did the two quarter-finals in Johannesburg. So I did the Ghana-Uruguay game, and I did the Spain-Paraguay game. And I remember that day, and I was looking at, is there a way I can get down to, I can't remember which around the two semis were, but Cape Town and Durban. How can I get down there? How can I find somewhere to stay? And it just wasn't possible. The flights were, you know, thousands of pounds. I just couldn't do it. And so then I thought, right, we have to stay in Johannesburg for a week. And I was looking at hotel prices, and I realised it was cheaper to fly back to London and then fly back out again for the final than to stay in Johannesburg. And once that thought's in your head, when you've had a pretty disappointing tournament, when it's been sort of a real grind for you and you haven't really enjoyed it, it doesn't go away. And you think, yeah, there's no point spending £2,000 or £3,000 to cover this one extra game. So I went home after the quarterfinals. Now, my experience of Russia was totally different to Miguel's. I loved Russia because I got the organisation, you know, spot on. I was basically stayed in Kazan for most of the tournament. I saw some fantastic football in Kazan. And Russia sort of really rekindled my love for the World Cup. But South Africa was the most sort of gloomy I'd been about the future of international football. And that was partly my own experience, was partly, you know, the quality of football, with the exception of a couple of sides, Spain being one of them, and the actual ball itself were so low, it just sort of felt like a decaying format.
Yeah, I mean, the South Africa World Cup was the first time I'd sort of dipped my toe into into going to a World Cup. I mean, we were out there covering the final. We didn't go to the match itself. We were in a fan park. So a very, very different experience, obviously, from yourself, Jonathan. And the whole, as we've mentioned before, that, you know, the backdrop of it being in South Africa was incredible, and so on and so forth. I mean, Miguel, how did you find that, the World Cup being in Africa itself? You know, you said it was the first time you covered it. What was that kind of experience? Did it kind of capture your imagination a bit?
It was. I mean, Jonathan's right about the distances travelled. And I think that's probably become a problem with the World Cup, that it's now so massive event that you almost need countries the size of continents to stage it. Mm-hmm. Because the first tournament I've ever done was Euro 2008, which is almost a dream tournament to do in terms of logistics, because for the Swiss cities, say, you could get to all of them within an hour and a half of each other, bar Geneva, which is only 2.5 or 3 hours away. And like all the trains are free. So that was so good to work around. Whereas this involved flights everywhere. So it meant my experience was a little bit more limited. I was only in Johannesburg and Sandton, or Soweto and Sandton. Soweto and Johannesburg, given it was Ellis Park in Johannesburg, Soccer City in Soweto, and then Cape Town. I absolutely loved Cape Town. Wasn't as mad on Johannesburg. I spent the tournament in Sandton, although obviously the stadium itself is now quite. I'll always have that kind of appreciation for it, or affection for it. I think Jonathan's right in terms of the tournament itself. Well, I mean, it was a bad tournament, a low scoring tournament, bad. And I think it had basically come at the end of this era in football, which is now. I think we've moved on to a completely different era. But it was the end of this period where the game fully moved towards the club game as the dominant side of football. And that's almost why Spain, and to a degree Germany, were so distinctive within that. Because they, obviously, I mean, Spain were ultimately founded on the Barca team. So they had a club cohesion that was basically beyond the majority of other teams in the competition. They just couldn't recreate that because they couldn't reach the same level. But it did made their games slogs as well, because... And I think this was very much influenced by Inter's approach to Barca in the 2010 Champions League semi-final that happened just 2 months before. It meant almost literally every Spanish game was basically them having 80% of possession or whatever it was, most of the game taking place in the 30 metres in front, around the 30 metre line in front of the opposition box, and defences kind of just sitting in tight about them, which I think took away from Spain, because I think, like as you saw at the start of Euro 2008, If they're allowed play against a team that opened up, they could be brilliant to watch as well. But it kind of made them boring. Look, and made all their games such. That's one thing that stands out for me during that tournament. Obviously, I had a massive vested emotional interest. But for everyone that goes on about how dull the tournament was, and even the final, it was a dull match. Although I watched it again recently, and I don't think it was a dull match. There were so many chances. But for me, it wasn't tedious. It was just every single game was so tense, and particularly actually almost as much as the final, the Paraguay game and the quarterfinal.
Yeah, Jonathan, I mean, obviously Spain got off to a losing start against Switzerland. What did you think of Spain under Del Bosque? Coming into the tournament, European champions, of course, we knew they were a great side. They'd sort of disappointed slightly in maybe one or two previous World Cups, and then they lose that first game. What were your thoughts on Spain in that first round?
I think I had great admiration for them without much affection for them. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that to sound sort of negative. I remember quite clearly during the semi-final against Germany, I was on a radio programme at half-time, and they you know, it was 0-0 at half-time, and they said, Spain are dominant, but they haven't got the breakthrough, they're going to have to change things. And me thinking, no, that's just not what they do. There's no need to change things. The nature of this Spain is they control games absolutely. And I think Miguel's right. I think Barca's experience against Inter had conditioned that. They were risk averse. I think Del Bosque's personality maybe lent itself slightly to that. And I think probably what happened against Switzerland sort of absolutely affirmed that was the way they were going to go about things. They were going to not take risks. They only let in two goals in the whole tournament. Switzerland and Chile were the only two teams to score against them. And so even that Germany game, there was just a sense that the nature of their passing, the nature of them having 70, 75% of the ball in every game, 80% of the ball, would eventually, the attrition of that would wear down an opponent. So after 45 minutes, you knew they had another 75 minutes, including extra time, to wait for the mistake. And as it turned out, in that game, it happened to be a set play. It wasn't a mistake. But if you have that level of domination, the team you're playing against has to A, be spectacularly focused, B, spectacularly fit, and C, spectacularly lucky to get away with it. And after Switzerland, no team was.
In relation, actually, to the how Spain got a bit more defensive, as well as that, in 2008, the only really defensive midfielder was Marcus Senna, who covered a lot. Whereas in 2010, Del Bosque put in Busquets, who was brilliant, obviously, and was kind of an improvement on Senna, but also put in Alonso. So almost had two pivots. And then I think that took away from both Xavi and Iniesta. It made Spain a little bit less fluid. Or no, maybe that's the wrong word. It made them just a bit more defensively, structurally sound rather than fluid in an attacking sense. And it maybe took Xavi and Iniesta a little bit away from where they were at their absolute best, just to add a bit more defensive security.
Yeah, and Spain's route to the final, I mean, they were, I suppose you could say they grew into the tournament, you know, losing their first game. And then even against Chile, I mean, they led 2-0, were pegged back 2-1. You know, they needed to win that game to make sure they went through. Tricky tie against Portugal, but with a better side. But you've already mentioned it, Miguel. That quarterfinal against Paraguay, against a decent Paraguay side, every team needs a little bit of luck if they're going to go on and win a tournament. So the amount of games you play and so on and so forth. You know, Paraguay score a goal, which was given offside, which wasn't. And they miss a penalty. So I grant you that, you know, Spain, you know, Xavi Alonso missed a penalty when he had to retake it after to scoring first. But Spain were a little bit fortuitous in that game. But it was so the idea of it being just quite boring. I agree with you. I remember watching that match and it was very tense.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, actually. The Swiss game very much set the tone for that entire tournament in Spain. It's every because they immediately needed to win. And it wasn't just about getting through the group. There was also the pressure that they wanted to avoid playing Brazil in the last 16. Obviously, it would have been much easier. They didn't win a game that massive that early. So it was key to try and finish top of the group as well. So straight away, there was this intense pressure on Spain. And that hung over every single match, which felt like it really culminated in that quarterfinal. And they were so close to going out. When you kind of look at it now, the Paraguay penalty so late in the game, even if you actually look at the goal that Villa scored, the nature, it almost had this this teasing nature to it. It was testing your emotions the way it hit both posts and then eventually went in. Mm-hmm. And I suppose Paraguay, a little bit like Inter with that Barcelona, were exactly the sort of team, because they were more suited to that defensive style, other teams weren't. Other teams kind of adapted it for Spain. Paraguay kind of fit into it more readily. They were exactly the sort of team that Spain hated play against. And one thing about that Spain as well, Jonathan kind of alluded to it there, but a little bit like Guardiola's Barcelona, is that as good as they could be, they had a glass jaw in a sense, because they were so based on possession, and this is of course why he brought in Busquets and Alonso. They were so susceptible to a sudden quick counterattack where, because they were so far forward and so much, if they suddenly lost in the wrong area, you know, they were at their entire half of the pitch was at the mercy of one run upfield. Mm.
And in the other side of the draw, of course, Jonathan, the Dutch are there. They've gone through their group, 9 points, so qualified handsomely into the second round. They beat Slovakia 2-1. It was their quarterfinal against Brazil, Dunga's Brazil, and they were fancied to go deep in the tournament, where Wesley Sneijder started to come into his own as well and become one of the talked about players of the tournament. That's where people started to believe that the Dutch could go all the way and it could be their first World Cup win.
Yeah, I mean, that game against Brazil was, I mean, I know it's a less famous game than the Ghana-Uruguay game, but in some ways I think that Netherlands-Brazil game was the best game of the tournament. And partly it was that, you know, we'd sort of got used to the Dutch losing to Brazil. You know, they'd done it in 94, they'd done it in 98. And you know, the way that was set up, I think there was an expectation something similar would happen. And as it turned out, that Brazilian system was very sort of blockish, and there was those spaces in their 4-2-3-1 just in front of the fullbacks, which Robin and Sneijder exploited, and Kuyt as well eventually. So that was the first game where I sort of thought, yeah, there might be more to this Dutch side than I'd anticipated. But what I find fascinating, and this is true of Spain as well, actually, is the conversation going on in the Netherlands at the time, which was, I don't think it was widespread, but it was certainly among a significant number of influential thinkers, journalists, former players, former coaches. There was a real sort of unease about how they played. And I think this is a particularly Dutch obsession. but there was a sense that this was somehow not quite the total footballing tradition. It wasn't quite in their, you know, in their best lineage. And there was a sense that under Van Marwijk, they were a little bit more pragmatic, a little bit more cynical. And then the fascinating thing about that is that although Spain essentially didn't take risks, their football seemed to be much closer to the Dutch ideal, which itself was sort of a rejection of the, and again, you know, this is a stereotype which doesn't always hold true, but the idea of La Furia Roja, which has existed from the Antwerp Olympics, was where the name was first given. This idea of this sort of that Spain were a team who played with great passion and great fury, and they never won anything with that. Well, they won European Championship, but essentially, they'd never done as well as they probably should have done in World Cups with that. And they are the team who sort of take on this intellectual, careful, possession-based Dutch tradition. So it's both sides have sort of turned against the stereotype of how they play. And I think particularly in the months after the final in the Netherlands, that became a huge, huge talking point. And initially, there was the sort of massive fans sort of thought, yeah, this is just the canal belt's intellectuals. This is not sort of real football. This is not actually relevant. But as time went by, I think there was a recognition in the Netherlands that this was, betrayal's too strong a word, but it certainly wasn't the sort of football they thought they should be playing.
Just on that, actually, you mentioned the kind of history of Spain as well, because this is something that really struck me and reminded me of my youth in the last few weeks when I've been working on kind of this Euro 96 stuff and Euro 2000 stuff. That, I mean, whatever about England's history in international tournaments and 40 years of hurt and all that, or 30 years of hurt, it was 96. Spain went through some really just chaotic campaigns that were just so frustrating. And they always seemed to get themselves into some, even though they were often a good team who should have done much better, it wasn't just that they underperformed in that sense. They got themselves into just these needless positions where they had to fight everything. Euro 2000 being a classic case where they lost the opening game to Norway, then had this manic recovery against Yugoslavia, and then Raul misses a penalty in the last minute against France. Hadn't got past the quarterfinals in any tournament bar Euro 84. They were beaten in the final by France, and even though they'd won Euro 2008, which did kind of break that mental hole a little bit, it did feel throughout 2010 World Cup that all of this was kind of teetering a bit, and like the Spanish capacity for underperformance, which it would have been underperformance if they didn't win that tournament. I mean, that's why, in relation to what Jonathan's saying there about Cruyff and all the rest of it, and those principles, Spain, it became about something bigger than Spain winning the World Cup, and Xavi, in that kind of really sanctimonious way he has, it wasn't just for Spain, it was for football, because it was seen as a kind of a victory of a certain style. And well, that's obviously kind of, self-serving.
He loves it, oh, yeah, he doesn't.
Quite annoying. But it was to some degree true in that they, like Barcelona, they basically pioneered, or maybe not pioneered is the wrong word, they were the high priests of a form of football that was becoming dominant in the game, not just international football. In fact, it was probably rarer international football because of the nature of it than it was in club football, where it was really becoming dominant. But, they were meant to be fulfilling all this. And had they failed and to win that World Cup, it would have been failing in a manner of ways due to their quality and also their approach.
And then the extraordinary thing is we then see the next two World Cups, 2014, 2018, just how sort of flimsy that was. I mean, we've gone straight back to Spanish chaos, whether that's getting smashed 5-1 by the Dutch, that sort of weird sort of brotherhood / rivalry, and then sacking their manager on the eve of the tournament.
Yeah, completely. I was thinking that myself. And also since 2012, when they did three in a row, the greatest achievement in international football, and the sort of thing you should think, completely changes a team's identity in the way that, say, 1958 did to Brazil. You know, it makes them winners. But since that, they haven't got past the last 16 of a tournament.
Yeah, man. All right, gentlemen, let's have a quick break, and after which we'll talk about the final itself. See you in a moment, everybody.
Van Bommel weaves his way between Spanish bodies. But when they win it, there's the opportunity to break and to slip Fabregas in. It is Cesc Fabregas. And just as Robin was foiled at this end of the field earlier by Casillas, so Fabregas is foiled by Stekelenburg.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Join me, Pete Donaldson, and Japan-based YouTuber Chris Broad every Wednesday as we offer the lowdown on what's happening in one of the most unique and exciting countries in the world. The Abroad in Japan podcast is home to all things Japan, from things to do...
So today we've come to you guys with 12 places in Japan that nobody knows about.
...to the bizarre...
When I moved into my new apartment last year, the police guy came to my door, knocked on my door, I opened it, it was a policeman, and he said to me, in English, I am Japanese policeman. That's the best introduction you could possibly do as a Japanese policeman.
To the downright filthy.
And for those of you that don't know what a tenga is... Pete and I did discuss how to describe it best before doing the podcast, and I'll let Pete describe what a tenga is. What is it, Pete?
It's a solo male silicon-based ordinist's aid, so to speak.
Brilliant.
New episodes every single Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Abroad in Japan is a Stakhanov production.
Welcome back to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Right then, chaps, let's talk about the final itself. If my calculations are correct, Jonathan, it was the first time since 1978 that we would be treated to a new world champion, because obviously the Dutch had reached the final a couple of times and they'd failed, and Spain had never won the tournament either. And going into the tournament, I mean, I had Spain down as sort of slight favourites, but you never know. But something about the match that I'd forgotten, and you alluded to this earlier, Miguel, it was very fast and frantic straight from the start. That first half was, in particular, had like quite a few incidents and so on, and it wasn't the kind of dull nil-nil affair that maybe some people might incorrectly remember it as.
No, there were a load of chances. I suppose straight away... The Dutch went in really aggressively on Spain,
And Van Bommel in particular. And I remember a lot of the Barca, or the Barca players were really irritated about that because they played with Van Bommel. Like Iniesta knew Van Bommel well, so did Xavi. But then it's a World Cup final. But that was obviously the Dutch approach straight off, and it set the tone because Spain were then maybe didn't go. I mean, there was no incident from Spain like De Jong's kick on Xabi Alonso, but they started to mix it themselves. And Iniesta was actually very lucky not to get sent off earlier. I think he was already on a booking. And kind of, he didn't quite elbow Van Bommel, but he kind of like shunted his body to kind of send Van Bommel flying. And, you know, a different referee rather than Webb might have sent him off. But I think that's what colours people's perception of the game, maybe, just that it was this kind of this air of aggression. But beyond that, there were actually a lot of chances. And it wasn't completely scrappy either. There was some kind of decent moves.
But it was straight from the off. After 4 minutes, Ramos had a header saved well by Stekelenburg. David Villa was nearly put through. After 8 minutes, Ramos again found himself in the box after 10. Villa had a volley from close range. Like quite a lot happened even in the opening 10 minutes of that match, which is just not how I remember it.
No, totally. I mean, again, the image is basically of that, of a especially when you kind of think back and just say 0-0 going to extra time, you just think it was a staid... tense kind of standoffish game, but it was very opposite of standoffish. They both did go for it if in different ways, with one kind of affecting the other. And even remember, beyond those kind of clearer Spanish chances, and the Dutch did have a few as well, there was I think one header from Matthiessen that he really should have scored from, but also I think very early on Casillas was nearly caught out by a massive punt up that he kind of just had to palm away barely, basically.
That's right, yeah.
But I mean, I think we saw here, not that anybody would have noticed at the time or talked about at the time, but we actually, you see here the seeds of what happens in 2014. That Dutch forward line with Van Persie and Robin and Schneider, and okay, Kuyt had gone by 2014, and the shape's changed slightly. But the pace and intelligence of those three, of Schneider, Robin and Van Persie, that is what can upset Spain. It's that capacity to counter-attack really quickly. And of course the irony of the whole thing is the Dutch don't like counter-attacking. They don't think that's sort of proper football. So the thing that Van Gaal slightly belatedly acknowledged in 2014 and set his team up to counter and had such success with against Spain, that was the thing that they were doing here. And you look at most of the Dutch chances, and it's the pace of Robin, it's the movement of Van Persie, it's Schneider, you're playing those precise passes into space. And so the tools that they had that they used so effectively in 2014, they were there in 2010. They just didn't quite get the break.
Yeah. Well, again, yeah. I mean, let's be fair. Well, actually, I was about to say Robben should have won the game. Everyone remembers that, but I think there were far more clear-cut chances in the match that could have been scored. But I suppose it was just... I mean, this is a classic of what we were talking about, where Spain, having dominated the ball... where suddenly that glass jaw was done again. Suddenly there was one punt up. It was Schneider with the ball forward, and Robben has put clean through on goal. And even
it's
image
an amazing
of that,
suddenly, pass. Yeah, that is a sensational pass. He especially with that ball, but you know it's a ball that bounces up and he hits it sort of kind of waist height or maybe sort of top of thigh height, and just sort of cushions it. Perfect weight for Robben to run onto, and the only thing you'd say is that maybe he's a little bit too straight. And that's what, it's quite difficult for him to work the angle and get it onto his left foot. But even then, Casillas has essentially gone the wrong way. It sort of hits the top of his ankle and spins wide. And you see Robin's face.
Yeah.
And Robin.
Can't believe it.
Robin thinks he scored. He thinks he's got enough height on his little clip on the ball. And then, nine times out of ten, that goes past Casillas' leg. This one clips the leg and goes wide.
Although, given the opportunity and what he could have done, I think it's quite a safe finish.
I know what you mean.
He could have been a bit more emphatic about it, given the scope of the goal he had. He basically took the chance on Casillas' dive. So I think there is some blame for Robin there. But on the other side, to be honest, one documentary I watch a lot, I suppose it's a bit more poignant now given Michael Robinson has just passed away. He did a brilliant documentary series, a brilliant documentary at Christmas in Forme Robinson called When We Are Champions. It's all in Spanish, obviously, but he has incredible access to the whole squad who basically are giving their take on every moment of the World Cup. And Puyol is the player that's chasing Robben at that moment. And he's talking about, and this is something that I found myself doing, I was watching it. As he's running after Robben and he sees Casillas come out, he finds himself, he said he can remember motioning his body to try and almost kind of influence Casillas to do the same. Like trying to, not so much mimic, but, you know, basically the way Sir Alex Ferguson used to kind of always, you know, head an imaginary ball when attack was coming in. Puyol was doing that for Casillas. And even 10 years on, watching that break again, even though I know what's going to happen, I'm so tense watching, I find myself motioning my body like Puyol, so Casillas does the same to try and stop it.
And then there's that other chance just after that when Puyol fouls Robben. And for once in his life, Robben stays
in his feet.
That's
about 20 minutes after. Because actually, David Villa has a brilliant chance about 7 minutes after that Robben one, where he should score.
Yeah, puts it over the bar. Yeah.
But that other. I mean, I sort of bring that up just because it's a similar type of chance. Robben gets behind the back four, and that time Puyol's close enough, and sort of there's a little bit of shoulder to shoulder. Robben gets in front of him, obviously being a much quicker player, and Puyol's arm goes across him, and if Robben goes
Puyol
down,
fouls him.
It is a foul. If he goes down, it's a red card.
Yeah.
Puyol said in that documentary, it's a red, definitely. But even that raises 2 points just in relation to that. I mean, because obviously the emphasis in that Spanish squad is obviously the passing and the midfield. But two players that really rounded that out in every sense. I mean, first of all, there's Casillas. And it feels like since Mourinho at Madrid, Casillas' legacy has taken a bit of a thumping. Whereas at that point, he genuinely probably was the best goalkeeper in the world. And he was so crucial, and this has been something that's not even emphasised with David De Gea and his struggles. He was so crucial to that Spanish squad. Because he was comfortable with the ball at his feet. And B, because of his willingness to come out off his line, not just in play, but also in terms of pushing up defensively, and which was seen in those two moments. And secondly, David Villa, who I actually think was the most important player in that Spanish team by far, because he gave them an incisiveness that they just lacked, that the passing lacked. He got that verticality, as they'd say now. And I think he basically, to a degree, dragged them through to the quarters. He scored all the crucial goals. Mm-hmm. Or dragged them through to the semis, really. And had he been at his best in the final, I think he was a little off that day. Spain win that more comfortably.
Yeah, I think David Villa, if he scored the winning goal in that final, people might talk about him. Obviously, Roberto Baggio didn't win the World Cup in 94, but that kind of tournament with a real standout player who, as you said, sort of dragged his team through and was so crucial. But with Casillas, you know, his influence can't be understated, because he makes the penalty save against Paraguay, saves that Robben one-on-one. And people can say, well, it's a bit fortunate, but it's a team game, right? And the goalkeeper's a part of that. Mentioning the foul on Puyol, and we have to talk about Howard Webb's performance in the final, because I believe both sides were very unhappy with it. Should Howard Webb have pulled that back and sent Puyol off and given a free kick? Or was he right to kind of play on and think, no, that's...
It's always difficult, I think, when the forward keeps going, because...
Well, and he might not have seen the foul.
Yeah, I mean, that one I think is difficult to see, because, you know, the ball's played forward very quickly, so Webb's slightly behind the play, and it's entirely conceivable that the Puyol's body blocks off Robin's angle. It blocks off his angle to see Robben. I honestly don't know what the right decision is. If there's an attempt to commit a foul that then fails, and the player goes on and misses. And then clearly Puyol's foul, it slows Robben down enough for Piqué to close him down. So he has to then sort of go to his right, as going on to his weaker foot. And that movement to his right is what allows Casillas to smother the ball. So I still think it is a red card, because he has stopped the clear goal scoring opportunity, but it's really not as clear as a lot of those decisions are. And it's certainly not as clear as the red card that De Jong should have got.
It also means it's not as clear a chance, because I think Casillas, unlike the one a few minutes before, Casillas smothers it quite comfortably in the end. It's quite weird, actually.
But he smothers it because Piqué gets across and Robben has to then go into his right foot.
Yeah,
so it's
exactly
a sort of two-stage process caused by Puyol committing the foul.
Yeah. But you're right, De Jong should have gone. I mean, it is... That's, I have some sympathy for Webb and that performance because of the amount that was happening. And obviously because the World Cup final, I suppose there's a certain maybe subconscious element where you want to try and keep the game flowing, even though this game was constantly disrupted by fouls. And you obviously don't want to start handing out all sorts of yellow cards. But that's probably that's obviously the one he got wrong.
The one thing I would say about it, though, it's one of those that when you see the still shot of it,
yeah,
it looks horrific because it's a boot going full into the chest. And certain angles, when you see the moving, the video footage of it, it looks horrific. But I have to say, when I first saw it,
yeah,
it was a red. It clearly was a red. However, I also think it's a kind of thing that people who don't watch a lot of football get very upset about, and people who do watch a lot of football just sort of, yeah, well, sometimes it happens, you know, should be a red, but move on. And because it's a World Cup final, it's been inflated. I think it's not quite as bad as a lot of people have made out.
Even what about whatever De Jong as well? Van Bommel probably should have got. I mean, Van Bommel by that point had about four or five yellow card worthy fouls. Like
was. Were there 14 yellows shown in the end in the whole game?
So many yellow cards. Yeah, so many yellow cards. But Howard Webb, he booked Van Persie sort of fairly early on in the first half for a foul, and as he booked him for that, he might not have booked him. That did set the tempo. Now I would say that the majority of the fouls then committed after that were yellow cards, at least, you know, as you've suggested, some of them. But am I right in saying, Miguel, that in Spain they didn't think much of Howard Webb's performance because of the De Jong foul, but also in the Netherlands they didn't think much of his performance because they felt that Puyol should have been sent off. So he ended up not pleasing either side.
I suppose everything with Spain since has been coloured by the fact they actually won it. So that's kind of a rush.
Sure.
I mean, if they hadn't won it, I'm sure there would have been a lot more anger, because even like I think more so than Webb, what I remember is the Spanish were more irritated with the Dutch players themselves. But that then passed because the players were really impressed by, and I think the Spanish public were really impressed that immediately after the game, the Dutch players gave them a guard of honour. So that, I think that helped kind of calm things down. So it meant maybe the anger. Obviously, there was a bit of criticism Webb, and especially if you watch some of the span, like you can watch the various Spanish commentaries of the game on YouTube now, and like, I think Webb is referred to a little less respect than might really warrant at some points. But then there is one of my favourite moments, and this is shown on a Robinson documentary, which obviously I was in the state at the time, so. So wouldn't have been conscious of any of this. But it's amazing, you know, after you've been at an event like that and after you see the highlights, how one experience starts to blur into the other. But there's a great bit on the Canal Plus documentary where in the very last minute, their commentator, I don't know the name of the guy, but he just writes basically pleading with Webb. This is how he ends his commentary. Hey, you know, for God's sake, Webb, blow it up. For God's sake, blow it up. And then, of course, you know, the attitude to Webb changes.
Yeah. I didn't. I mean, no,
I do think. I mean, Miguel mentioned the sympathy as well. I mean, I completely do as well because, as a referee, what are you meant to do in a game like that? You book Van Persie early as a sort of look. I'm not going to stand for any nonsense. I'm a police officer from South Yorkshire. Don't mess with me. And they keep doing it.
Yeah.
And if you keep that same level of booking every player who commits a foul. Like Van Persie had, then suddenly you're the referee who sent off eight people in a World Cup final. And if you did that in a league game, people would talk about you for forever. But if you did it in a World Cup final, you know, so I think I've said this on this podcast about Kalina, a huge part of refereeing. And I think this is true at any level, is about your body language and your sort of the air of authority you project. And that almost matters more than whether you get 85% decisions right or 95% decisions right. That somehow your personality has to control things. And Howard Webb is a massive bald bloke who's a policeman. You know, he does project authority. And yet even he, in that game, you know, sort of nobody was paying any attention to him.
Well, I actually think he's been harshly derided by some people, obviously being a neutral fan. Watching the game. I, as you say, Jonathan, he said, you know, Van Persie's one, he's kind of got, right, come on. But then I'd say pretty much every other foul that he dished out a yellow card for, he was right to. And
oh, yeah. I mean, the criticism is he should have dished out more yellows. But you kind of think he's given out 14 already. You know, at some point, it becomes the player's fault, right?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think the most extraordinary statistic of that final, taking everything to account, is it took 108 minutes for the only red card of the game to be given. You know,
it was actually quite innocuous as well by the time it was given.
Yeah,
because it's just kind of like this feather touch on Iniesta, who at that point, I think, probably, to be fair to him, probably frustrated with how night's gone. Iniesta goes down quite easily under that push.
Yeah,
from John Huitinger. I mean, it was.
Sorry,
Huitinger. Yeah, yeah. But yes, into extra time. I mean, even extra time was more sort of tense and exciting than I remembered. And as we've mentioned, you know, Robin had his chances in the 90. Villa had a great chance. Ramos had a free header, and then into extra time. I forget, Jonathan or Miguel, or you were both saying that Spain controlling the possession and dominating. When they ground down teams, you know, this is where we began to see it. They had a penalty appeal turned away. Fabregas had a one-on-one that was saved. The game was opening up. Iniesta was causing problems, Miguel, and this is where Spain's style really came into its own.
Yeah. Also, it's one thing I should really remind Richard Jolly of, given his fascination player. But this is probably also Jesus Navas' greatest moment. Because he offered... They'd taken Villa off by that point for... Actually, maybe it was a little bit later for Torres. But he brings on Navas. And Navas's direct running basically complements Spain's passing because it suddenly... Oh, it kind of punches further holes in the Dutch defence. And that's why, obviously, it's a Navas... It's a 50-yard Navas run. It's really impressive, to be honest, if you watch it again. But that basically just breaks open the game and then initiates the move that leads to the goal.
I mean, there'd been the Fabregas chance before that, hadn't there? Which was, I don't know. As a Spain fan, were you starting to think, it's just going to be one of those days where we never get the breakthrough?
No, I was actually, and this was something that I think it's Iniesta mentions it. Oh no, it's David Villa. Sorry. And from what I remember, I think I was thinking the same. It's easy to say now. Maybe I've been influenced by comments like that. But because the Dutch missed those chances, and because they felt so big, it felt more like it was going to be Spain's night. And also, by that point, I think the Dutch were starting to recede more and more. And by the time Fabregas should have scored that chance. I mean, he's put clean through. It's basically one-on-one with the keeper. And it's worse than Robinson's, since he kind of just puts it straight at Stekelenburg. It was a shot that basically kind of a bit like a penalty in that sense. It was one of the easiest for the keeper to save, even if he did well. But there was still a sense that something was coming, and that Spain were more and more just beginning to push the Dutch further and further back. But then again, I mean, it's the latest winning goal ever, isn't it?
In a 116th minute.
Mm. Yeah. But the red card for Johnny Huitinger, he just opens up a little bit more room. And you thought to yourself, I mean, it's got to be sort of now or never for Spain, as you say. I mean, penalties were looming, but the Dutch don't have a great record in penalties, even though Spain had missed a couple of penalties.
No, not in Spain at that point, but it's improved since because of that team.
Well, but in Euro 2008, they beat Italy on penalties. Yeah. I think you would have fancied Spain on penalties, of course. But playing that kind of last sort of 10, 15 minutes, whatever it was, of that final with the Dutch down to 10 men, you must have thought to Miguel, right, it's got to happen now. Yeah. This is
it. Yeah, that was actually, that's as much as Jonathan was kind of saying. It's because the chances and because the yellow card. And again, due to that red card, they're starting to get in behind more and more. There's just that bit more space. And it did feel, and also I think that the Dutch were really tiring at that point, whereas the Spain had a bit more to go. I think they'd use their substitutions better. I can't actually remember the Dutch subs. I remember all the Spanish ones. But yeah, it just felt like it had tipped, and that Spain were beginning to get in behind more and more. And I mean, I was very, very nervous at the time. I think I was almost on my feet in that massive south. I was quite lucky in that sense. I was beside Dion Fanning and Ken Early. Both of whom were working for Sunday papers as well. So at the very least, I wasn't disrupting anyone who was writing live. But I imagine I was getting increasingly agitated. I mean, there's always this thing. We all know, in like when you're in a press box like that, you are conscious. I mean, I'd absolutely never be like one of the many Spanish journalists that were literally going to the game in Spanish jerseys, or the way you see Roncero go to the Champions League finals in Real Madrid jerseys. There is still that element of decorum. Sometimes you allow yourself kind of quiet fist pumps under the desk. I shamefully did that when Diego Costa equalised against Portugal in Sochi in 2018 in the opening group game. But for this, I imagine I was. You'd have to ask the lads in this, maybe, but I was a lot more agitated. Even back before the game, I remember there was a massive walk from the media centre to the actual stadium, and I was nervous, and so I had a lot of kind of this nervous energy. I remember myself and Ken were walking up to our seat in the press box, which is quite high. We were at the Irish Press at the time. And from wherever we were in the stadium, we heard the kind of closing ceremony, which is Shakira's Waka Waka song. I remember Ken turning around to me, "Is that Shakira?" And we both sprinted up to our seats. but I'd like to say that was a reflection of the tension I was suffering, rather than, you know. As far as World Cup songs go, it's quite a good one.
Yeah. I won't ask you to comment on that, Jonathan. But the goal itself...
Well, of course, I met Shakira in 2006 on my 30th birthday, which is very good of her to come.
Yeah. Did she perform?
No.
She did, yeah. In a massive stadium in Berlin. Zinedine Zidane rather spoiled my big day.
But it's good for all those people to turn out for you. Yeah. But Jonathan, the goal itself then, Iniesta's...
Yeah, so as Miguel says, it's Navas who makes it, really. I mean, it's not his assist, but it's his driving run. And there is a big piece by Richard Jolly on the Blizzard website about his fascination for the great man. Navas drives forward. He's sort of held up, and it ends up with Fabregas sort of repaying the compliment to Iniesta for the chance he'd had 5 minutes earlier. And the ball just sort of bounces up. I'm not really sure. It must sort of get half blocked. And it bounces up, and then it just sits perfectly for him. And you sort of,
I think in that moment before
he strikes it, you know that he's going to score.
I think it's a pitch. And every time I look at that chance now, and invariably it's slowed down, it actually, because of the way the ball bubbles up, you feel as if that could easily have been blazed over by any player, but Iniesta just catches it so purely. And his own quotes on that are really good. Basically, like he puts it, basically, when you're in a moment like that, it feels like everything is going in slow motion. But he said, I knew exactly what I was going to do, and like the split second I hit the ball, I knew it was going in. And of course, Iniesta probably one of the players with the purest technique in the world at that point. But of course, one of the most special elements of the goal is that at the height, for what is the greatest moment in Spain's football history, but also obviously by far the greatest moment in Iniesta's personal career, a really deeply kind of individual moment in that sense, and what it means for yourself. And yet, at the moment of that, at the moment of ecstasy, he basically shares it with his dead friend. He lifts his shirt to reveal Danny Harkey, who died from a heart condition, with the former Espanyol player, always with us. Maybe should have got booked for that.
I think he did get booked.
No, I don't think he did, because I think he already had a booking earlier in the game. Sorry, you're right. Actually, you're right. He did get a booking for it, because he got a booking for 118th minutes. Yeah, so Webb must have booked him, for it. I have thought about that. Even as you score the goal, and just especially after a game like that, and the tension and the release of finally getting it, it'd be easy to forget. But he doesn't. He whips it off straight away and makes sure, like at that moment, the world remembers his friend. It's really touching. And of course, if you read Iniesta's book, which Sid has translated into English, And even that documentary emphasizes as well, Danny Yarke, who died in September 2009, it made it an extremely difficult year for Iniesta personally. He wasn't at his best for Barca. He, as well as he's kind of the mental toll of his friend's death, there was a physical toll. He missed 3 months of the season. He missed the semi-final against Inter, and you know there was all sorts of talk whether had he been on the pitch, maybe Barca would have had enough to go through. And he started that campaign unfit, and he, a bit like Spain, he kind of gradually found his form as the tournament came on, and was probably their best player from the quarterfinals on.
A fitting end to an amazing tournament for Spain. And Miguel, it's been enjoyable actually going over that tournament with you, and especially the final, because, as I say, I perhaps remembered it slightly incorrectly. It was a better final, even though there was just the one goal in 120 minutes. But yeah, Spain's dominance shining through in South Africa. So yeah, thank you, Miguel. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast once again, Jonathan. Yeah, indeed. And for more stories like that, do check out theblizzard.co.uk, as Jonathan's already said. But thank you yourself, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. We'll see you next week.
They try to open up the Dutch via another route. Iniesta's in the middle all alone. If Fernando Torres can find him, it's stabbed away uncomfortably to Fabregas. Surely now, Spain have won the World Cup for the first time in history.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.